but it is clearly implied because we have an option enlisted personnel do not have. We can resign our commissions in protest and are expected to do so. Another puff on the cigarette, followed by a moment of silent thought. Are you going to resign? John finally asked. Bob looked over at him.
Your thoughts, John?
Is it about here? John asked. The fact that someone, in fact quite a few, knew on the morning of the day that we were going to get hit, took care of their own, and said the hell with the rest of us?
In part.
Bob was silent for a moment. He took another drag on his cigarette and sighed.
So damn much is clear now. We knew a practice drill was going on the day we got hit, and most of the personnel that took over after that day by chance had been in Bluemont. At least I and others believed it was by chance. Hell, drills like that are being pulled all the time. We just came to assume that a few more that took over made it to Bluemont in the weeks afterward.
He stood and looked out the window of the room to the open floor of what had been built in the 1950s, to serve as the war room to keep on fighting from if Washington was destroyed.
This was built to fight a nuclear war from, once ICBMs with flight times of but minutes came online in the late 1950s, and warning time went from hours down to just a few minutes. Those of us working in the Pentagon knew we'd all be gone in those first few minutes, and this place was all but forgotten. A relic of a different type of war from a different time. And now to find it was activated and running with family stashed here.
He looked back at John, tears in his eyes.
6 hours warning, and I could have gotten Linda out of Florida. All of us could have done something. For that matter, we could have scrambled everything we had and perhaps even targeted the container ships in the Gulf of Mexico and off the California coast before they hit us. It's all too much to absorb, John.
I spoke to a woman who said her husband claimed that a select few knew something was coming, but assumed it would be just a nuclear strike on D.C., and I would guess maybe New York. John wearily shook his head.
Just D.C. and New York,
John whispered again.
Just 10 to 15 million dead.
My God, what kind of mentality thinks such a loss would be a small number, and that would reset the political paradigm in their favor?
There's intelligence chatter all the time, Bob sighed. If one believes all of it, every day you go crazy, you know that. Maybe they thought that it was just a mid-level alert. I guess we'll never know for sure. Bastards who would sit back for that think of themselves first. I doubt if we'll ever get the truth from them.
By the way, John said, breaking the tension of the moment with a sad smile, it was her husband sending those love notes. Not to his wife, but to his mistress, stashed away in the highly secured other end of this facility that gave us the clue about Site R. I told her you have the letters. She is so pissed off, I'm certain she'll sing like a canary for us if we need more info later.
Typical, Bob said softly, wearily shaking his head. So typical of so many moral scum we all had to salute at one time or another.
But to the core question, sir, John asked. Is it about what they did to us all or what they are going to do to us next?
Go on.
I see one side of the dilemma that you are dwelling on being what happened, but, sir, the more pressing issue is what they're going to do next and how you will reply.
Keep talking.
Now Bob lit his third cigarette. All of this started to unravel when you received orders, when was it, not much more than a day ago, to pull your entire command back to Roanoke. It meant that Bluemont was preparing to pop an EMP to destabilize Atlanta, take out communities like mine that are resisting them, and I guess send a message to China as well not to push beyond the Mississippi. It comes down to the fact that they are willing to hold and execute power whatever the cost. I just heard someone quote Milton, "Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." They scrambled to protect themselves when all hell cut loose and then seized the reins of power afterward. Whether that was their plot beforehand or not, we most likely will never know. But since the day, what they've done, what they are planning to do next, that, sir, is the issue of the moment to focus upon. Bob closed his eyes.
By the rivers of Babylon, There we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. He looked over at John, the 137th Psalm. He whispered, I dwell on it often when I think of all that has happened. And you are saying we cannot let our tongue cleave to the roof of our mouth, or our right hand forget its strength. Bob made no gesture of reply. Enemies, foreign and domestic, it all turns on that, sir. Not just what they did, but what they are about to do to hold on to their power. To protect the Constitution, it is therefore right for you to act. His gaze was no longer fixed on John as if he was staring off to some distant place. And to not forget the Jerusalem that they allowed to be destroyed, John interjected, whether they thought it would be, forgive me for even saying it, just a strike on Washington and New York that would reset the political paradigm and power structure, or some suspected it would be a full-scale EMP strike. It happened. Now they're ready to do it themselves against the southern United States. Why? A message to the Chinese, for one, Bob said softly. If we're now willing to do such against our own territory, still in rebellion against them as they see it, the message would be clear. They're so desperate that they will order the same against everyone else in this world if they think they're about to go under. Second, it was to knock out people like you who were beginning to rise back up and put things together, and who at some point would look at Bluemont and start asking questions.
Therefore? John asked.
We have to hold to our oaths to protect the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, Bob replied, strength returning to his voice. Yes, I took over what they called Eastern Command. I actually believed restoring order using our traditional military had to be done, but the ones I was first fighting against were barbarians like that posse you wiped out. But then you were in front of me, John. That is when the inner question started for me. I was ordered to bring you in. I tried to reason back that you had been provoked into that fight with Fredericks because you had no alternative but to fight. It didn't fly. I thought I could work my way around it, get you to cooperate peacefully, which you did order, and then they tried to kill you anyhow. That assassination attempt was, of course, to kill you and your family as vengeance for your defiance, but it was a message to me as well that I was being watched and to toe the line. And thus the questions began to hit at last on my part in all of this.
He looked over at John.
Forgive me for not protecting you better.
Nothing to forgive now, sir, John replied, but in his heart he knew if Michaela had been killed, that would have taken him beyond any forgiveness.
When they ordered me to pull back to Roanoke, I knew I had to act, but how? Then your friend Linda handed me the deepest paradox of all. Did at least some of them know what was about to happen before the day, protected themselves in their own, and left the rest of our country wide open for what then followed? That finally tipped it. That is why I had to come here and settle for myself what had to be done.
He forced a weary smile.
What I have to do now.
Bob turned away from John and lowered his head. John knew what he was doing. He had seen it just days before in the chapel at Montreat. He remained thus for several minutes. John heard him whisper,
Thy will be done.
Bob made the sign of the cross and then leaned back in his chair and looked over at John.
Get that administrator, or whatever he is, back in here, Bob said, and his voice was firm.
John opened the door, pointed at Pellegrino, and nodded to the guards, who shoved the trembling man back into the room.
Again, I must protest this kind of treatment, Pellegrino started, but an icy glance from Bob silenced him.
Bob pointed to the control booth in the far corner of the room.
Do you know how to operate the equipment in there? Bob asked.
Pellegrino shook his head.
Find someone who can do so now.
Pellegrino hesitated.
Now!
Phyllis is our communications person, Pellegrino blurted out.
Get her in here, Bob snapped.
John opened the door, pointed at Phyllis, and beckoned for her to enter, which she did reluctantly.
First of all, get me on the phone with Bluemont again and put it on speaker. I want you and Colonel Matherson to hear it.
Pellegrino did as ordered, pulling over the red phone on the desk Bob was sitting at and pushing a single button that lit up on the face of the phone. Bob picked up the receiver.
"Who is this?"
a woman's voice answered on the other side. Bob looked over his shoulder at Pellegrino.
"I said I want this on speaker."
Pellegrino looked to Phyllis, who switched on a speaker mounted above the desk.
"This is General Robert Scales here."
There was a pause.
"We demand that you put Mr. Pellegrino on the phone now," the woman replied.
"It's the other way around," Bob replied. "Whoever calls themselves president where you are, you put that person on the phone."
"Just who do you think you are?"
came the sharp reply.
"General, you have been stripped of rank effective immediately. You are to turn yourself over to Mr. Pellegrino and the head of security where you are. Any who continue to obey your orders will face the severest consequences. He will be escorted to a secured area where you wait until our forces arrive."
Bob actually smiled at that.
"Go to hell."
"What?"
Her voice was almost a shriek, and as it rose in volume, John found himself looking at the loudspeaker with surprise. He recognized who she was.
"Madam, you are to recall your forces now, immediately."
"Mr. Scales, it's the other way around."
"I hold the trump card. You do not."
"You're an egotistical fool. You have fewer than 80 with you. We realize that now. You've undoubtedly learned by now there are additional security forces within the site. Whatever chance you had is finished. If you surrender yourself, I promise leniency for all those deluded into following you, and that is our only offer."
Bob cupped his hand over the receiver and looked at John and the two guards.
"Tell her to kiss our asses," one of the troopers replied. "Every man and woman under your command is with you, sir."
Bob nodded his thanks and then looked at Phyllis.
"I want you to turn those cameras on and set up an uplink."
"To what?"
she asked nervously.
"BBC, for starters. China, the whole damn world."
"I will not."
"I can have one of my tech people in here in less than 5 minutes and do your job for you,"
Bob replied coolly. She did not move.
"Get someone. Sergeant McCloskey can handle it,"
Bob snapped to the two guards in the room, and one set off at a run, but the other guard came up close to John.
"McCloskey's dead,"
the guard whispered to John. He could see Bob hesitating. Such a rare sight. But all of it had become also overwhelming. Every second that passed raised the chance that a counterstrike could hit them, and as if in answer he could hear what sounded like gunfire from outside the command bunker. Chances were they were about to be overrun. What had to be done, he knew Bob most likely was contemplating, but the moment dragged out, gunfire growing louder, and for John it came down to Lee, Grace, Jennifer, and all those who died, all those who would continue to die.
"Sir,"
John snapped, and he extended his hand out, indicating he wanted the phone. Bob looked at him in surprise, but then handed the phone up.
"This is John Matherson. You might not know who I am, but I know who you are."
There was a pause from the other end.
"The terrorist from Carolina?"
It was more a question than a reply.
"A citizen from Carolina who knows that you plan to take down the entire southeast region of the United States with another EMP burst within the next few days."
"What difference does it make that I'm talking to you instead of a general now formally stripped of command?"
she snapped.
"I'll tell you the difference, ma'am."
There was no reply, but over the loudspeaker, John could hear whispering from those who were most likely in the same room with the woman on the phone.
"I want all of you to listen closely. General Scales might not be comfortable with ordering this, but I no longer have a problem after everything you bastards have done to us, to our country."
"How dare you?"
"I dare because I can destroy this place in a matter of minutes."
Another pause, whispered voices, and finally a reply, as if she were trying to laugh his words off as an idle threat.
"It was built to withstand a direct hit on the surface from a nuclear weapon. Unless you have one with you, John Matherson, your words are just that. Words.
But we are inside. This place has a central ventilation system. I have enough of my people here that we will blow that. For starters, there is fuel storage, gasoline, and diesel. We will dump it and light it off. The barracks are made of wood. After 60-plus years down here, they'll burn like torches. Your food supply is centrally stored. We already know where that is. 100 gallons of gasoline tossed in there and lit, and the life of luxury in here turns into the way people like my family have been living for over 2 years, while your families are fat, warm, well-fed, and safe. Your water cisterns, I'll blow them, and while everything burns at this level, we'll flood out any lower levels beneath this one as well. We will blow this place, and in 1 hour, every single person in here will be standing out in the freezing cold. And let me guess, do you have grandchildren in here? How dare you threaten them, you son of a bitch! She shrieked. So you do have them here. So let's make this clear. I bet there are a couple of dozen in that room with you, and all of you have families here. And by the way, if your so-called Secretary of State is there, tell him his wife knows about Alicia and is waiting to discuss his mistress. I offered to loan her my gun, and I think she's eager to use it. He could hear loud cursing and then the voice of someone being muffled. Don't you dare try to play a blame game with me. We are not terrorists who will kill children. But you most certainly are a terrorist. My daughter died because of people like you. So the choice is yours. Call your attack dogs off both inside here and any coming from the outside, and we continue to talk. Otherwise, I'm handing the phone back to General Scales. We start smashing this damn hiding hole, and you figure out what to do with everyone in here when they're standing outside tonight in 2 feet of snow when another storm is rolling in. I am a man of faith, and I swear to you before God, I will not harm a single innocent person in this place. But I also swear to you that unless you back off now, every person in this place will be living like the rest of America in another hour. At least I'll give your people time to get into warm clothes, if they have any, and one pouch of an MRE each. But that is it. And that is a damn sight more than you and yours ever gave to the rest of this country 2.5 years ago. I've said my piece. It is now you who have 1 minute to decide. John tossed the phone down on the desk and looked over at Pellegrino. Get on there and tell her I'm not bluffing, John shouted. Bob sat in perfect silence, looking up at John in surprise. John drew out his Glock and pointed it at Pellegrino. Tell her I'm not bluffing, John shouted. John. It was Bob speaking, but John did not look at him. Tell her. Hands shaking, Pellegrino needed both to pick the phone up. He has a gun to my head. He's just crazy enough to do it. 1 minute for the shooting in here to stop and for you to halt whoever is preparing to hit us, or this place starts coming down, John shouted. He means it, Pellegrino cried. A pause, more arguing from the other end, and someone sobbing their kids were in the middle of it and to back down. 30 seconds! John shouted. All right, all right, she cried. It sounded like she was muffling the mouthpiece of the phone, but all could hear her shouting to get on a comm link to the security team in Sector Alpha and order them to cease fire and withdraw. Tell her she just bought herself a few more minutes, John said, looking at Pellegrino, who nodded and gasped out the message. John stepped to the door into the room, telling the one remaining member of their team standing watch to go out to the gate and report back whether all was secure. The distant sound of gunfire finally ceased. 2 minutes turned to 3, and then 4. The guard, breathless, ran back into the cavernous main hall and then up to the communications center. Whoever they are, they've apparently pulled back, sir. John nodded and lowered his weapon away from Pellegrino, and the man visibly shuddered and sighed with relief. How bad was it? Bob asked. 2 of our people at the gate are down. I think one is dead. John wanted to ask if his own friends were safe, but knew he could not do so now. Bob nodded and took the phone from Pellegrino. Every death now is on your head, he said. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. But if any moves are made, if anyone tries to approach from outside, what Matherson said will come to pass. He hung up without waiting for her reply and looked back at Phyllis, who, though obviously frightened, was displaying more nerve than Pellegrino. You and I need to talk, and I promise you, either way you answer, no harm will come to you. You have my word of honor on that. She nodded, but did not reply. Bob spared a sharp glance toward Pellegrino and motioned to the door, and the breathless trooper hustled him out of the room, closing the door. Sit down, Phyllis. Bob offered her a chair. She did as requested, and Bob motioned toward the pack of cigarettes. She shook her head, but he drew one out for himself, as did John. Phyllis, how long have you been here?
Since the morning of the day the war started.
Why you? Are you a family member of someone in Bluemont?
No, sir.
Then why?
I'd rather not say.
That could mean a lot, but John sensed what it might be and did not press the question. And you being in here in this room when I came in, Bob continued,
I was assigned to work communications here. I used to be a producer and sometimes anchored for a television station in D.C.
For John, that seemed to fall a bit into place. She was tall, highly attractive, the type that would be pushed in front of a camera to interview some government official. It was easy enough to see what had developed out and why she was alive here rather than long ago dead back in Washington.
I think you know that outside of here, Bluemont, and I can only assume now a few other places our country has gone to hell.
She just nodded, head lowered.
It could have been you out there, Phyllis.
My parents. A sister.
She paused.
A guy who was once my boyfriend.
Phyllis, do you know that Bluemont is preparing to launch an EMP strike against our own country?
She hesitated.
There have been rumors,
she whispered.
And your thoughts on that?
She did not reply. John could see what Bob was trying to do and gently moved in on the conversation.
Phyllis, there are hundreds of communities like mine that just barely managed to survive. Barely. We're starting to crawl out of the dust. Basic things. Get at least a trickle of electricity up and running. From that, the chemistry lab in the college where I teach is again making anesthesia and antibiotics, things we once took for granted. Phyllis, have you ever witnessed an amputation with the victim wide awake? No pain pills afterward? No way to stop infection once it set in?
She stared at him wide-eyed and then lowered her gaze and shook her head.
How about watching a diabetic child die because her frantic parent could not find a single vial of insulin?
Another shake of her head, but her glance turned back up to him.
Yes, that was me. My daughter was 12, and I held her as she died. Even with just a few extra hours' warning, so much could have been different. Phyllis, those of us left are trying to crawl out of the hellhole of what happened, and those in Bluemont are about to hit us, to push us back down into that hole. Bluemont is going to smash all that within the next 2 to 3 days because it doesn't fit what they see as their plan.
Look at me, please, John said, and she raised her head.
How old was your sister?
14.
My daughter was 12 when she died for want of a vial of insulin.
He held the eye contact, and this time she did not break away.
What do you want me to do?
She finally whispered.
John stood just behind Phyllis, who was at the control board. It was lit up. She had indicated to him and Bob that the uplink was hot and also being fed to Bluemont as well.
If she was bluffing, she was being damned good at it, and he could only hope for the best and that she had made a moral choice. Or, as Bob had interjected, a penance, and it was time for her to set her own moral choices straight.
Bob was sitting behind the desk at the far end of the room. Phyllis looked over at John. He's on, she announced, and she turned her attention back to the display board.
John wasn't quite sure what to do other than just hold his hand up and wave.
Bob nodded and looked at the camera, and John could see the image on a small screen in the control room. Certainly not the professional quality the world had once grown all so used to, but it would have to do. There was no makeup, no smile, just a firm, determined look.
My name is Robert Scales. Until an hour ago, I was a serving major general in the United States Army and in command of all Army operations in what was defined as the Eastern Mid-Atlantic Command Zone. My task, as assigned to me by an entity located in Bluemont, Virginia, claiming that it was the reconstituted government of the United States of America, was, and I quote, from the orders I was operating under, to return to federal control all territory from Charlottesville and Richmond, Virginia, to the north, the Appalachian Mountains to the west, and the border with Florida to the south. Until 2 days ago, I diligently followed those orders, believing that the entity located in Bluemont that claimed it was the government of the United States was a legitimate government. I no longer believe so, and that is why I am making this broadcast now. Several days ago, I was made aware of two actions by those who claim to be the government. One, a crime of unsurpassed magnitude on what so many of us now call the day. The other, a crime of nearly equal magnitude that same government was planning to commit within the next 48 hours. I shall review those crimes shortly, but before doing so, I am making the following statement and then demand. An hour ago, I wrote out my letter of resignation as a serving officer in the United States Army so that it can never be stated that one following a tradition going back to General Washington and those who served with him rebelled against his government. I therefore resigned and now have the freedom to act as a private citizen. Bear that in mind as I now make this demand. I demand that the criminal entity that claims to be the federal government based in Bluemont resign from office. That applies to the so-called president and every other official there. All of you who resign will stand trial by a duly created civilian court, for your crimes are of such magnitude you must face juries of your peers. Do not resign, and you shall be construed as in rebellion against those who defend the Constitution of the United States and dealt with accordingly. He paused and looked over at John for a few seconds, who had been carefully watching Phyllis's actions. Nothing seemed amiss. She had claimed to be linking the signal not just to Bluemont, but also to several frequencies commonly monitored by ham operators, the frequency of America's Voice of Victory, as it was now called, and even more important, the BBC. Her hands were shaking, and he looked over at her. She was in tears, but then whispered, "I'm with you on this now." John gave a reassuring look back to Bob. "I shall now review in detail my charges against those in Bluemont, an explanation of where I am now, and all that this place called Site R, from where I am broadcasting, symbolizes." He spoke for nearly a half hour. Amazing, John, with his ability to have thus organized his thoughts, laying it all out clearly with no teleprompter, relying on nothing more than a few sheets of paper with notes scribbled on them with a Sharpie. John continued to watch Phyllis's actions. She stuck to her post, not making any attempts to shut things down. Bob had run down the list of events going all the way back to the day, and how it was now clearly evident that a very select few in the government, and beyond them political leaders and high-level economic leaders not directly in government, had word of the impending attack, conspired to conceal it while ensuring the safety of themselves, their families, friends, and allies, and ensured as well their seizing dictatorial power afterward. This cabal, as he called it, had ceded more than half of what had been America to other nations in order to ensure their continued hold on power, and finally had plotted an EMP strike as a means of suppressing those attempting to rebuild and as a dangerous political ploy against the rest of the world. Why did they sink to this lowest of moral crimes? Bob finally asked. I don't know for certain. The warning about the threat of an EMP attack has been out there for years. Decades, and yet no one acted on it. Was it ignorance, or was it simple, dumb disbelief? Perhaps for many, yes. But I recall all too well an interview with someone who was fully aware of the threat long before it hit. When he was asked why there was no action to prepare, his reply was, "Don't we, the ordinary citizens of our country who are aware of the threat, realize the elites will take care of their own no matter what happens?" This day I have found that those who claim to be our government, based in Bluemont, did take care of their own, while the rest of us faced the day without warning. And hundreds of millions died. Every one of their deaths rests on those who knew and said nothing while looking out for themselves. I must add that I believe that some, for perverted reasons, saw this as a means of seizing power, no matter what the ebb and flow of politics, fearing perhaps they would soon be voted out of office. And the sickest crime of all is that, to paraphrase Milton, who in Paradise Lost once wrote of Satan, they felt it was better to reign in the hell they created than to serve in heaven. To a world, to Americans who lost so much but still survive, to personal friends, I must ask you, should such as they be allowed to continue on in power? I point no finger at one political view or another. Our petty arguments of left or right, liberal or conservative, seem so inane now in contrast to what we endured together. Regardless of what we once felt on such things, I believe we are united with these revelations that we must stand together to ensure that government of, by, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. In conclusion, Bob finally said, I can only speak now as a private citizen, having resigned my commission in order to be free of what any might construe as a military coup. All men and women in uniform must now make a choice. If you are an officer, remember your oath is to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It is your choice to decide if those in Bluemont are enemies of our Constitution and then act accordingly. I am asking that any force commanders in possession of nuclear weapons go to a full lockdown and vow that under no circumstance whatsoever will they deploy or launch such a weapon except in response to nuclear weapons launched by another country against what is left of the United States until a properly constituted government formed within the original guidelines of our Constitution has been recreated. Only after that takes place, with a duly elected and morally guided government in place, will those in direct charge of such weapons unlock them, strictly to ensure the defense of our country against outside threats. I am asking that those military forces directly attached to Bluemont, either defensively or currently moving toward offensive action to retake Site R, go to a full stand down. I no longer have such power to order you to do so, but your unit commanders can. I am asking that any civilian-based military units within a 100-mile radius of Bluemont move upon it now. I pray that there shall be no violence offered from our regular armed forces, who will instead join you in occupying Bluemont and placing under arrest any who are still there. Where I am located now, near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, is the underground shelter I spoke to you about earlier. Having resigned my commission, I have no power to act here, but I am requesting of the officer who is taking over in my place to ensure that the civilians who have lived here safely for 2.5 years shall be protected. Our own Constitution makes clear that no family member can be punished for the crimes of a parent or spouse. However, if those in Bluemont do resist or attempt to seize this place by force, all civilians within Site R will be ordered to evacuate and find whatever shelter and sustenance they can in the outside world all the rest of us have resided in for the last 2 years, if that is indeed the tragic result. I ask that you show them more compassion than their leaders have shown to us. So what is next? Bob asked, and he looked at the camera for a moment, as if almost expecting to hear tens of millions of replies. I leave that to you, my fellow citizens. Our once proud cities and our once beautiful capital have been reduced to ruin and ashes. I see the land around Bluemont to somehow be accursed. I will therefore close with a suggestion. I ask that 30 days hence, 5 representatives from each of the surviving states come to meet here at this place. I ask that you good citizens decide how they shall be selected, as it was once done when the founders met to frame our Constitution. I ask that we reaffirm that Constitution and create a reunited Union of States. Why here?
He paused for a moment. Within sight of this place I am now broadcasting from, our nation, once divided, fought the bitterest battle of a bitter war. And yet, 50 years later, and again 75 years later, former enemies met as friends, standing on opposite sides of a stone wall on a place called Cemetery Ridge, and shook hands in friendship. But a few hundred yards from that wall, President Lincoln stood before the newly made graves of those who gave the last full measure of devotion and proclaimed that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth.
There was another long pause. In your hands, my fellow citizens, and not mine, now rests the fate of this nation. I ask that Almighty God grants us his peace and guidance in the days to come.
He sat back in his chair, eyes still on the camera. Phyllis waited for some sort of signal, but he gave none, and finally John whispered, "That's it." She reached across the board and threw a number of switches off, and then looked over at John and began to cry.
"I'm sorry I was ever here,"
she whispered. "Consider what you just did as atonement," John replied. He stepped out from the narrow confines of the control booth and walked up to where Bob remained motionless.
"I guess all we can do now is wait and see what happens," Bob sighed. "We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth," he said, as if to himself.
Chapter 19 2 days after the collapse of the Bluemont government.
"If I could order you to stay, I would," Bob said, extending his hand.
John could only smile and shake his head. "I've had enough of it all, sir."
"Come back as a delegate?"
"What was it that Sherman said?"
"If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve," Bob replied.
"Something like that." "They're coming," Sergeant Major, now Colonel Bentley, announced. John looked back behind Bentley. A half-dozen men and women of what had once been Bob's command, which he had turned over to Bentley after promoting him to the rank of colonel before resigning his commission, came out of the tunnel bearing a flag-draped coffin. All came to attention. And even though Bob was no longer serving in the military, old instincts were still within him as he came to attention and saluted as Grace's coffin was respectfully loaded into the Black Hawk. Maury followed, limping and helped by Forrest, along with Kevin and Reverend Black. Earlier in the day, in honor of his friend's request, Lee Robinson's mortal remains were lifted by helicopter to what was truly hallowed ground in front of the iconic statue dedicated to the men of North Carolina, who had advanced across a sun-drenched field in what would forever be remembered as Pickett's Charge. Reverend Black had read from the 91st Psalm, Lee's favorite, and with full military honors he was laid to rest in the ground he had often said, quoting Joshua Chamberlain, that here indeed was the vision place of souls. It was hard for John to imagine life ahead without his stoic friend by his side. Together they had often joked, if they had indeed lived 150 years ago, they would have faced each other as honor and duty demanded, but their bonds of friendship would have endured. John wished that a photograph taken of the two of them together had survived, but it was lost when his house burned in the war against the Posse. They had attended a historical event together, and there posed for an authentic ambrotype, Lee in gray uniform, John in blue, Lee's hand resting on John's shoulder in a gesture of friendship and love. So much was still in doubt. All thanked God that the military garrison at Bluemont had not tried to attack Site R. They had all gone to their barracks to wait it out. As to the elite located in a highly secured reserve area at the far end of the cavern, it was apparent that some attempted to flee via a hidden exit. They were met by a hovering Apache and fled back inside. Some had urged Bob to personally lead a move, either to arrest those within that special compound or to execute them summarily, but he announced he would not do either once it was learned that a missile that was indeed nuclear-tipped and had been moved into position at Wallops Island, Virginia, had been rendered inactive by troops there. The warhead atop the missile was seized and impounded by a team of Navy SEALs operating from a carrier off the coast, whose commander announced he would no longer accept orders from Bluemont, would remain in stand-down, and would await orders from whatever government in compliance with the Constitution was created. Global reaction was compounding by the hour, some announcing that Bob should act as temporary dictator, president, or whatever he wished to call himself. China made clear it was occupying up to the Mississippi, and again issued the threat that any action against their humanitarian aid being offered to the stricken former United States would be construed as an attack upon their mainland. But just this morning word had come in via the ambassador in China, who had served under the Bluemont government, but after Bob's broadcast announced his allegiance to a properly formed government, that the Chinese foreign minister had informed him that as long as no action was taken against their occupation forces or their homeland, China would recognize the new government. If anything, at this moment, rather than a help, John saw himself as a liability for what Bob was attempting. In its dying gasps, Bluemont had played a recording of his conversation, heavily edited, to make it sound like he was indeed threatening to murder everyone inside of Site R. Unfortunately, no one had thought to record the conversation from their end, and John realized the best thing now was to distance himself from Bob until everything settled down. But beyond that, he was weary and exhausted from all that had transpired, and the thought of yet more years of struggle to come had become overwhelming. The turbines of the Black Hawk started up, and Bob motioned for John to step away for a moment. Bob reached into his breast pocket, pulled out a nearly empty pack of cigarettes, and offered one to John, who accepted, and Bob lit John's and then his.
"Thanks for getting me hooked on these damn things again," Bob said.
"Sorry, sir."
"I might have to call on you, John, but for now maybe it is wise you just head back home for a while. That doctored recording does make you seem like a hard ass."
"I saw it had to be done, sir, and I didn't want you in that role. Better me than you."
"Thank you, John."
They both stood silent for a moment.
"My question, John."
"Anything."
"Would you have done it?"
"What?"
"Smashed the place apart and driven those thousands out into the cold to starve?"
John looked past him, gaze lingering on the distant hills of Gettysburg. All the sacrifice that happened there, all the sacrifice endured there and up now to this moment.
"Sir, don't ever ask me that question again," John whispered.
Bob nodded.
"Understood, my friend."
The helicopter rotor began to turn. The two dropped their cigarettes, John grinding his into the snow to put it out. Bob held out the pack, offering the rest to him. John smiled sadly and shook his head.
"I once made a promise, sir."
Bob looked at him quizzically and then seemed to understand and nodded.
"I'm quit now. Quit forever. This is the final day."
Epilogue. May the peace of the Lord be with all of you on this most blessed of days of renewal and beginnings. I hereby declare the academic semester to be open. There was a scattering of applause as Reverend Black, newly appointed president of the college, stepped away from the lectern of restored Graham Chapel of Gaither Hall, the name having been changed in memory of an honored couple who had resided in Montreat for most of their lives and actually been married in the chapel in a long-ago age. There was the traditional closing hymn, the school song, led by the choir, and as they finished, the congregation started to leave. But then a lone voice from the choir began to sing a song that struck John to the very core for all its symbolism. The lone female voice echoed in the restored chapel. "Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and, oh, so mellow." All stood frozen in place, and more than a few began to weep. John looked over at Michaela,
remembering the first time he had brought her to this chapel. A student up on the stage, unaware that she had an audience, had started to sing that song from the Fantastics. It had become something of a theme of the time they had been through, a song of remembrance and loss. Young Jenny was nestled in against her mother, having fallen asleep through most of the service, but was now stirring, looking up sleepy-eyed at her father and smiling. He put his arm protectively around Michaela's shoulder and walked with her out of the chapel into what was proving to be a glorious early May morning, the date symbolically chosen since it was exactly 3 years ago that the day had struck them all. And now, phoenix-like, the school was again stirring to life. Following old tradition, John gathered with the other faculty at the base of the stairs to shake hands with the students leaving and heading to class. Mixed in were members of the community. Maury was still a bit ungainly with crutches as Forrest helped him down the steps. Maury's leg wound had become infected. Michaela had struggled with it for over a month before finally conceding it had gone gangrenous and amputating it. As he was helped down the steps by Forrest, who had become a dedicated friend to Maury during his long months of recovery, the two together reminded John of old photographs of Civil War veterans, minus a limb, helping each other along, sharing a bond that someone who had not been through their fiery trial could never understand. Most of the students who shook John's hand were the survivors, as they called themselves, their features hard, wiry, hands gnarled from an early spring of putting in crops. Most had already put in several hours of labor in the fields before returning to campus. Until the harvest was in, there would be but 3 hours of class a day near noontime, and then back out later in the day to resume work. His daughter Elizabeth was mixed in with the crowd. Now the mother of two, she was not attending classes but had come for the ceremony, honoring all those who had fallen with the reading of the names of all students, staff, and faculty who had given the last full measure of devotion. As Lee Robinson, killed in action, Gettysburg, was read off, John saw her lean in closer to her husband, Seth, Lee's son, who bowed his head as she held him close. For John, the fact that his comrade's son was registered in his class filled him with happiness and poignant memories as well. In a long-ago time, Lee would visit his class as a Civil War reenactor to talk about the equipment, uniform, and life of the troops. Seth, even as a 10-year-old, would proudly attend wearing a uniform handmade by his loving mother. He looked so much like his father and would forever be a reminder of one of the closest of friends. John saw a man coming down the stairs who but a few years ago must have been full of the vigor of life, but on this day looked broken. He had arrived on campus only the day before. He was one of several dozen parents who, across the months since the onset of a relative semblance of peace, had made the journey to discover the fate of a son or daughter sent to this quiet, peaceful campus before the coming of the day. "We want you to stay with us for several days," John said as he grasped the man's hand. "There is so much to share with you about Grace, to tell you all that she meant to us, all that she did." John's voice filled up. He had once thought of himself as being so stoic, able to contain his emotions, only letting them release when alone. Perhaps it was Jennifer that broke that in him. He had lost Jennifer. This man had lost Grace. Grace's father smiled but offered no reply either way. "I think I'll go and sit with my girl for a while," he whispered, and then continued on. John watched the man walk down across the front lawn of the campus for the long trek to the military cemetery at the edge of town. John had taken him there the day before, and was touched to see that someone was still thoughtfully putting flowers on her grave, suspecting it was Kevin, who had taken her loss in such a way that it was obvious that he had been deeply in love with her. "You'll be late, Professor," Michaela announced, and John looked over at her, smiled, kissed her lightly, bent over to kiss Jenny, who stretched up to him with chubby arms for a smoochie, and laughed as he mussed her hair, blonde like her mother's. He left his family and started on the short walk to his classroom. Then, as he so often used to, he stepped into a tiny octagon-shaped building just 10 feet across, three of its 8 sides open to face onto the bubbling creek that flowed down through the middle of the campus. It was the campus prayer porch, a favorite place where he used to often come to sit, to listen to the creek tumbling by, at times to pray, at times to just soak up a moment of peace and solitude before the start of a class. The walls were covered in graffiti, without exception all of them touching. A brief quote of scripture, a thank you God, a heart with initials in it, but so many now, R.I.P., my love. I miss you, sweetheart, and I'll see you in heaven. Several hundred names were written on the walls in long, orderly rows, the names of all those from the college who had died in the war. Too many. Far too many. He sat in silence looking at them. As years would pass, as it did with all wars, the pain would lessen, the aura and legends would grow, as was so with nearly all wars, and memory of the names would drift into history. The issues of this war were still in doubt. The day of the reopening of the school had been chosen because of all that was symbolized by this day in May, 3 years to the day since the start of the war. Some things that John had said to the man who this day would be sworn in as a duly elected president must have stuck, and though John did not remember it, the new president did. That there was a final day, and what John had learned was to be the theme of his inaugural address to be delivered at the hallowed resting place of Gettysburg. That the war had reached its final day. Perhaps it was just rhetoric. Half the country was still occupied by foreign powers. As for those who once ruled from Bluemont, some had indeed met their fate at the hands of angry mobs that eventually stormed the facility while their Praetorian guard had shown the wisdom of standing aside, in the same way the original Praetorians would do at times with an unpopular emperor when a mob stormed the imperial compound. Many, though, had managed to disappear, John musing that such was often the case with people like that, a few cropping up as far away as South America and Africa, though one such nation, thinking it would be a friendly gesture, publicly hanged several of them. Within sight R, there had actually been a standoff for several weeks between the guards and dwellers in what was actually known as Section Alpha and the troops under Colonel Bentley. The guards of that section finally agreed to disarm, and for those within to face the same fate as the rest of the dwellers of Site R. As for those elsewhere in the facility, it was a profound moral question for the nation as to what should be done with them. The majority favored just driving them out into the snow where more than a few waited just beyond the fence that encircled the compound to loot them at best or deliver far worse punishment. Many, therefore, still resided there after Bob, citing the example of Lincoln, appealed that to take vengeance on them was not in the spirit of what the country should again aspire to, and that it was accepted that the statement against attainder of blood meant that no person could be punished for the crime of another family member. The consensus was growing to let each of them take 2 to 4 weeks' worth of rations and find transport back to wherever they originally lived, though many now pleaded there was no place for them to go, that their spouses and parents were dead or had fled from Bluemont and disappeared. Upon the revelation that Bluemont had indeed planned to loft an EMP over the southeastern United States, nearly every officer in the military had refused to accept further orders, and within days declared that their oath was to the Constitution. As such, they would follow legal orders from a higher commander who had not been tainted by direct association with Bluemont, and waited for such a person to be chosen. It was finally agreed that an admiral aboard one of the surviving carriers, who had ordered his SEAL team to seize the nuclear-tipped weapon at Wallops Island, and was clearly untainted by any direct association with Bluemont, would serve as chief of all military operations until a new president was in place. Bob's appeal for the beginning of a convention to reestablish a federal government had gotten off to a rocky start, ironically nearly identical to an argument when the original Constitutional Convention was held. Why were certain delegates sent rather than others? Who had the power to choose the delegates or even issue such a call for a meeting? Some states, particularly high food production states, had experienced far fewer casualties than small, urbanized states, such as New Jersey, which was all but depopulated, as was Rhode Island. There was also the question of whether delegates of states west of the Mississippi would be admitted. Texas, which was fighting what was nearly a full-scale war against Chinese and Mexican incursions, flat out said it was quit with the Union and wanted to proclaim that its boundaries should be what they had been when it was an independent republic, which had once included most of the Southwest clear to California and parts of Colorado and Utah. A smart compromise had actually been suggested by a history professor out of Purdue, who specialized in the pre-Civil War South, suggesting that the 13 original states should send the original number of delegates, and once a quorum was convened, delegates from states in order of their admission into the original Union would be greeted once the Constitution was reaffirmed. The idea, of course, was immediately seized on by those within the original states. It was seen as a way out of an impasse that threatened to cripple Bob's hopes before they were even remotely attempted. And therefore, this day, what Bob at his inauguration as president called the final day, marked the beginning of a restored United States of America. Henceforth, this day in May would be observed with the same reverence as July 4th, but also as a day of reflection, as December 7th and September 11th were once observed. The ringing of the campus bell stirred John from his musings. It was time. He stood up, leaning over the railing. A blossom in the thicket of rhododendron that all but engulfed the small building was beginning to bloom. He gently plucked it free, held it for a moment, and then let it drop into the stream. "Jennifer, sleep in peace, my little angel," he whispered. He reached into his jacket pocket and drew out Rab's, flame scorched but still intact. The house next to where he had buried Jennifer and her grandmother was gone. There was no longer a windowsill for Rab's to rest upon and keep watch. But here, he realized, was a sacred place as well, where the names of so many others who had been lost were engraved. His gaze lingered on Grace's name, recognizing Kevin's handwriting. Picking up a pencil from the small table in the room, he wrote Jennifer's name beneath Grace's and placed Rab's on the table. "Keep watch over all of them now, my little friend," he whispered, patting Rab's affectionately, eyes clouding with tears as he finally let go of the pain. All on this campus knew who Rab's was, and all would keep watch over him as well, and he would remain in the chapel as days, months, and eventually years slipped by. John left the peaceful chapel, entered Belk Hall, and climbed the three flights of steps to the third floor to what he had once considered to be his classroom. Of the 35 seats in the room, only a dozen were filled. He paused for a brief instant, taking that in, and he could not help but think that so much had been lost. Could they ever truly hope to recover? One of the students, face creased by an ugly wound from the battle with the posse, instinctively stood up and came to attention, the others following his lead. The man, for he was a man who was not even 20 yet, his childhood from a world that used to say, 25 is the new 18, had been robbed of adolescence forever. Would there ever again be a childhood for this generation? He looked at the old-style mechanical clock on the classroom wall. It was noon. 350 miles away, a friend of his, some hailing him as a George Washington reborn, others denouncing him as nothing better than a dictator, was being sworn in as President of the United States. But then again, had not the same been said of Washington in his day? The legend not yet formed, and ahead yet more wars, strife, a civil war that came close to forever rendering the Union apart, and from there global wars and finally the war of this generation. Such had it been, and whether with hope or fear, such it would always be. There had been a chance to have prevented it all, but all the voices who had warned of its coming had been ignored, the mute testament of that folly, the fact that two out of every three chairs in this room were empty. So many ghosts he could see hovering about those chairs. Not just Grace, who, at least for a while, would be remembered until, like all heroes, memory would fade even for her. So many others already half forgotten, their memories for him the ultimate price of the folly of letting those who let the nightmare unfold so easily take power and wield it, while with honeyed words dripped lies of assurance and reassurance that they would all be taken care of. Forgotten the prophetic words that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. He realized that he had been standing before the class for several minutes, gazing at the room in silence. Several were in tears as they looked upon him, and he felt his throat tighten. "Stand at ease and be seated, please." He looked around the room, smiled, and then, as he once used to do at the start of every class, John Matherson asked a question. "Now, where did we leave off?"
This concludes the reading of The Final Day by William R. Forstchen, copyright 2016 by William R. Forstchen. This book was read by Bronson Pinchot. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Spectrum Literary Agency and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.